hypothesis, everything aligns behind it. Beyond denial or horror, tearing away every doubt and every emotion that might stand in its path. And then David Munro and Lord Voldemort had just been one person playing both sides of the Wizarding War, and that was why the Munro family had been killed before they could meet David Munro, just like Moody had suspected. Reality settled down into a single known state, one coherent state of affairs that compactly generated the observation set. Harry didn't jump, didn't change his breathing, tried not to show a single sign of the horror and agony flooding his mind. The enemy was behind him, watching him. "All right," Harry said out loud as soon as he dared trust his voice to sound normal. He kept on staring at the bodies, looking away from Professor Quirrell, because Harry didn't trust his own face. Harry lifted a sleeve to wipe away the sweat on his forehead, trying to make the gesture look casual. Harry couldn't control the sweat, or the rapid hammering in his chest.
"Let's go get the Philosopher's Stone."
All Harry needed was a single moment of distraction, anywhere along the way, to use his time-turner. There was no reply from behind him. The silence stretched. Slowly, Harry turned around. Professor Quirrell was standing upright and smiling. In the defense professor's hand was a shape of black metal, pointed at Harry's wand arm, held with the sure grip of someone who knew exactly how to use a semi-automatic handgun. Harry's mouth was dry. Even his lips were trembling with adrenaline. But he managed to speak.
"Hello, Lord Voldemort."
Professor Quirrell inclined his head in acknowledgement and said,
"Hello, Tom Riddle."
Chapter 105. The Truth, Part 2.
"Tom Riddle."
The words seemed to echo inside Harry's head, sparking resonances that as quickly died away. Broken patterns, trying to complete themselves and failing.
"Tom Riddle is a... Tom Riddle was the... Riddle."
There were other priorities occupying Harry's attention. Professor Quirrell was pointing a gun at him. And for some reason, Lord Voldemort hadn't fired it yet. Harry's voice came out in more of a croak.
"What is it that you want from me?"
"Your death," said Professor Quirrell, "is clearly not what I am about to say, since I have had plenty of time to kill you if I wished. The fateful battle between Lord Voldemort and the boy who lived is a figment of Dumbledore's imagination. I know where to find your family's house in Oxford, and I am familiar with the concept of sniper rifles. You would have died before you ever touched a wand. I hope this is clear to you, Tom."
"Crystal,"
Harry whispered. His body was still shaking, running programs more suited to fleeing a tiger than casting delicate spells or thinking.
But Harry could think of one thing the person pointing a gun at him obviously wanted him to do. A question that person was waiting for him to ask, and Harry did so.
"Why are you calling me Tom?"
Professor Quirrell regarded him steadily.
"Why am I calling you Tom? Answer, your intellect is not everything I hoped for, but it should suffice for this."
Harry's mouth seemed to know the answer before his brain could manage to focus on the question.
"Tom Riddle is your name. Our name. That's who Lord Voldemort is, or was, or something."
Professor Quirrell nodded.
"Better. You have already vanquished the Dark Lord, the one and only time that you will ever do so. I have already destroyed all but a remnant of Harry Potter, eliminating the difference between our spirits and enabling us to reside in the same world. Now that it is clear to you that the battle between us is a lie, you might act sensibly to advance your own interests, or you might not."
The gun jabbed slightly forward, causing prickles of sweat to appear on Harry's forehead.
"Drop your wand. Now."
Harry dropped it.
"Step away from the wand," said Professor Quirrell.
Harry obeyed.
"Reach toward your neck," said Professor Quirrell, "and remove your time turner, touching it by the chain only. Place the time turner on the ground, then step away from it as well."
This also Harry did. Even in his state of shock, his mind still looked for a way to spin the time-turner in the process. A sudden move that would win. But Harry knew that Professor Quirrell would already be imagining himself in Harry's position, looking for the same possible opportunities.
"Remove your pouch and place it also on the ground, then step away."
Harry did this.
"Very good," said the defense professor. "Now, it is time for me to obtain the Philosopher's Stone. I mean to bring along these four first years here, suitably obliviated of their most recent memories, so that they still recall their original purpose. Snape, I shall control and set to guard this door. After this day's work is done, I intend to kill Snape for the betrayals he has offered my other identity. The three heir children I shall take with me afterwards to shape their future loyalties. And know this, I have taken hostages. I have already set in motion a spell that will kill hundreds of Hogwarts students, including many you call friends. I can stop that spell using the stone if I obtain it successfully. If I am interrupted before then, or if I choose not to stop the spell, hundreds of students will die."
Professor Quirrell's voice was still mild.
"Do you yet perceive any interests you have at stake, boy?
I would smile to hear you say no, but that is too much to hope.
I'd like,
Harry managed to say through the horror and the heartbreak, and the knives slicing away at an emotional connection that hurt like living flesh as it was cut.
For you not to do those things, Professor. Why, Professor Quirrell? Why? Why did it have to turn out like this? I don't want this to be happening.
Very well, Professor Quirrell said. I grant you permission to offer me something I want.
The gun gestured invitingly.
That is a rare privilege, child. Lord Voldemort does not usually negotiate for what he wants.
Some part of Harry's mind scrabbled frantically, looking for something, anything that might be of more valuable to Lord Voldemort or Professor Quirrell than child hostages or Severus's death. Another part of him, the part that had never stopped thinking, already knew his answer.
You already have an idea for what you want from me,
Harry said, through the sickness and the bleeding wounds in his soul.
What is it?
Your help in obtaining the Philosopher's Stone.
Harry swallowed. He couldn't stop his eyes from going to the gun, then back up at Professor Quirrell's face. He was aware that the hero in a storybook was supposed to say no, but now that he was actually in a situation like this, saying no didn't seem to make sense.
I am disappointed that you need to think about this, said Professor Quirrell. It is straightforward that you should obey me for now, since I hold every advantage over you. I have taught you better than this. In this situation, you should certainly pretend to lose. You can expect to gain nothing by resisting, except pain. You should have calculated that it was better to answer sooner, and not earn my distrust.
Professor Quirrell's eyes studied him curiously.
Perhaps Dumbledore has filled your ears with nonsense about noble defiance. I find such morals amusing, since they are so easy to manipulate. I assure you, I can make defiance seem morally worse, and you would be well advised to submit before I demonstrate how.
The gun stayed pointed at Harry, but with a wave of Professor Quirrell's other hand, Tracy Davis rose up into the air, spun lazily, her limbs stretched out, spread eagle. Then, even as new adrenaline hammered at Harry's heart, Tracy floated back down again.
Choose, said Professor Quirrell. This begins to try my patience.
I should have spoken just then, before he might have ripped off Tracy's legs. No, I shouldn't have. The headmaster said I mustn't show Lord Voldemort that I'll do things if he threatens my friends, because that will just make him threaten more of them. Only, what he said before isn't a threat. It's just the sort of thing Lord Voldemort does.
Harry took a deep breath, several of them, Whatever part of him kept on running on full automatic was screaming at the remainder of his mind that it could not afford to stay in shock. Shocks were of finite duration. Neurons kept firing regardless. The only reason Harry's mind would shut down while his brain kept running was if Harry's self-model believed his mind would shut down.
"I don't mean to try your patience," Harry said, his voice cracking.
That was good. Sounding like he was still in shock meant that Lord Voldemort might give him more time.
"But if Lord Voldemort had a reputation for keeping his bargains, I don't know about it."
"An obvious concern," Professor Quirrell said. "There is a simple answer, and I would have enforced it upon you in any case. Snakes can't lie. And since I have a tremendous distaste for stupidity, I suggest you do not say anything like, 'What do you mean?' You are smarter than that, and I do not have time for such conversations as ordinary people inflict on one another."
Harry swallowed. Snakes can't lie.
2 + 2 = 4.
Harry had tried to say that 2 + 2 = 3, and the word 4 had slipped out instead.
"Good. When Salazar Slytherin invoked the Parselmouth curse upon himself and all his children, his true plan was to ensure his descendants could trust one another's words, whatever plots they wove against outsiders."
Professor Quirrell had adopted his lecturing pose from Battle Magic, like someone putting on a well-worn mask. But the gun remained pointed in his hand.
"Occlumency cannot fool the Parselmouth curse as it can fool Veritaserum, and you may put that to the trial also. Now listen well. Come with me. Promise your best aid in getting stone, and I shall leave these children behind unharmed. Hostages are real. Hundreds of students die tonight unless I stop events already set in motion. Will spare hostages if I obtain stone successfully. And mark also this. Mark it well. I cannot be truly slain by any means known to me, and loosing stone will not stop me from returning, nor spare you or yours my wrath. Any impetuous act you are contemplating cannot win the game for you, boy. I do credit your ability to annoy me, and suggest you avoid doing so."
"You said..."
Harry's voice was strange in his own ears.
"That the Philosopher's Stone had different powers from what legend said. You said that to me in Parseltongue. Tell me what the stone really does before I agree to help you get it."
If it was something along the lines of gaining total power over the universe, then nothing was worth an incrementally greater chance of Lord Voldemort getting the stone.
"Ah," said Professor Quirrell, and smiled. "You are thinking,
That is better. And as a reward, I shall offer you a further incentive for cooperation. Eternal life and youth, the creation of gold and silver. Suppose these are true benefits of holding the stone. Tell me, boy, what is the stone's power?
It might have been the adrenaline still in him, being actually useful for his brain for once. It might have been the power of being told that an answer existed, and that the evidence wasn't a lie.
It can make transfigurations permanent.
Then Harry stopped as he heard what his own mouth had just said.
Correct, said Professor Quirrell. Thus, whoever holds the Philosopher's Stone is able to perform human transfiguration.
Harry's torn mind was knocked about yet again as he realized what further incentive would be offered him.
You stole Miss Granger's remains and transfigured them into some innocuous-appearing target, said Professor Quirrell. A transfigured target that you must keep somewhere about your own person in order to sustain the transfiguration. Ah, I see your eyes going to that ring upon your hand. But of course, Miss Granger would not be the little jewel set into the ring, would it? That would be too obvious. No, I expect you transfigured Granger's remains into the ring itself, letting the aura of the transfigured jewel mask the magic in the transfigured ring.
Yes,
Harry said, forcing out the word. It was a lie, for once, and Harry's glance had been deliberate. Harry had expected someone to challenge him on the steel ring. He'd tried to provoke that challenge so he could prove to be innocent yet again, though nobody had taken him up on it. Maybe Dumbledore had just sensed that the steel by itself wasn't magical.
"Fine and good," said Professor Quirrell. "Now, come with me. Help me to obtain the stone, and I will resurrect Hermione Granger on your behalf. Her death has had unfortunate effects on you, and I would not mind undoing them. That, as I understand you, is your greatest desire. I have done you many kindnesses, and I would not mind doing you this one more."
A blank-eyed Professor Sprout had now risen from the ground and was pointing her own wand at Harry.
"Help me obtain Stone of Transfiguration, and I shall try my hardest to resurrect your girl-child friend to true and lasting life. That said, boy, I am swiftly running out of patience with you, and you shall not like what comes next."
This last line was hissed out in a voice that conveyed the impression of a snake rearing its head to strike. Even then, with all the world upturned, with shock after shock, even then, Harry's brain did not stop being a brain, or completing the patterns its circuits had been wired to complete. Harry knew that this was too good of an offer to make to someone at whom you were pointing a gun. Unless you desperately needed their help to get the Philosopher's Stone out of the magic mirror. And there wasn't any time left to plan, only the thought that, if Professor Quirrell really was going this far to get his help, what Harry wanted was to demand Professor Quirrell promise not to kill anyone in the future in exchange for his help now. But Harry had a strong sense that Professor Quirrell would reply, "Don't be ridiculous," and there wasn't time for ordinary conversation. Harry had to guess the highest safe request in advance. Professor Quirrell's eyes narrowed. His lips parted.
"If I help you," Harry's mouth said, "I want your promise that you aren't planning to turn on me when this is over. I want you to not kill Professor Snape or anyone else in Hogwarts for at least a week. And I want answers, the truth about everything that's been going on this whole time. Everything you know about my nature."
The pale blue eyes regarded him dispassionately.
"I really think we could have thought of something better to ask than that," said Harry Slytherin side. "But I suppose we were legitimately out of time, and whatever we need to do next, answers will help."
Harry wasn't listening to that voice right now. Cold chills were still going down his spine from hearing the words that had just come out of his lips, addressed to the man with the gun.
"That is your condition for helping me to obtain the stone?" said Professor Quirrell.
Harry nodded, unable to form words.
"Agreed," hissed Professor Quirrell. "Help me, and you shall have answers to your questions, so long as they are about past events and not my plans for the future. I do not intend to raise my hand or magic against you in future, so long as you do not raise your hand or magic against me. Shall kill none within school grounds for a week, unless I must. Now, promise that you will not attempt to warn against me or escape. Promise to put forth your own best efforts toward helping me to obtain the stone, and your girl child friend shall be revived by me to true life and health. Nor shall me or mine ever seek to harm her."
A twisted smile.
"Promise, boy, and the bargain will be struck."
"I promise," whispered Harry.
"What?"
screamed other parts of his mind.
"He's still pointing a gun at us,"
pointed out Slytherin.
"We don't actually have a choice. We're just getting as much mileage out of this as possible."
"You bastard,"
said Hufflepuff.
"Do you think this is what Hermione would have wanted? This is Lord Voldemort we're talking about. Do we even know how many people he's killed and will kill?"
"I deny that we are compromising with Lord Voldemort for Hermione's sake,"
said Slytherin.
"Since there is, in fact, a gun, and we can't otherwise stop him. Also, Mum and Dad would want us to just go along and stay safe."
Professor Quirrell regarded him steadily.
"Repeat the full promise in parcel tongue, boy."
"I shall help you obtain the stone. I cannot promise I will use my best efforts. My heart will not be in it, I fear. I intend to try. Shall not do anything I think will annoy you to no good end. Shall call no help if I expect them to be killed by you or for hostages to die. I'm sorry, teacher, but it is best I can do."
Harry's mind was settling, composing itself as the decision was made. He would stay with Professor Quirrell, go with him to get the stone, save the student hostages, and Harry didn't know, except that he'd go on thinking.
"You actually are sorry about that?"
Professor Quirrell looked amused.
"I suppose it shall have to do. Then keep two other things in mind. I have planned to stop even Schoolmaster if he appears before us. And also this. I will occasionally ask you to say in parcel tongue whether you have betrayed me. The bargain is struck."
After that, Professor Sprout picked up Harry's wand and wrapped it in shimmering cloth. Then she placed it on the floor and again pointed her wand at Harry. Only then did Professor Quirrell lower his gun, which seemed to disappear into his hand, and pick up Harry's wrapped wand, tucking it into his robes. The true cloak of invisibility was removed from the sleeping form of Lysarth Lestrange, and Professor Quirrell took the cloak, as well as Harry's pouch and time-turner. Then Professor Quirrell cast a mass obliviation, followed by the mass version of the false memory charm, the one that just had the subject fill in the blanks using their own suggestibility on all the students present. Afterwards, Professor Sprout floated away the sleeping children, now wearing an expression that seemed annoyed and preoccupied, as if they'd been in some herbology accident. Professor Quirrell then turned back to where the potions master lay sprawled, bent over and placed his wand on Professor Snape's forehead.
"Alienus nervus mobile lignum."
The defense professor stepped back and began to move his left fingers in the air as though manipulating a puppet on strings. Professor Snape pushed himself up from the ground by smooth motions and stood once more before the corridor door.
"Hallo, Amora," Professor Quirrell said, pointing his wand at the forbidden door.
The defense professor looked rather amused.
"Would you do the honors, boy?"
Harry swallowed. He was once again having second thoughts. And third thoughts. It was strange how you could do something, even while knowing it was the wrong thing. Not the selfish thing, but the wrong thing to do, on some deeper level. But the man behind him was holding a gun. It had once more appeared in his hand at Harry's hesitation. Harry laid his hand on the door knocker and took several deep breaths, again composing his mind as best he could. Go through with it. Don't get shot. Don't let the hostages die. Be there to optimize events. Be there to watch for opportunities and stay capable of taking them. It wasn't a good choice, but all the other ones seemed worse. Harry pushed open the forbidden door and stepped through. Chapter 106. The Truth, Part 3. After a single step into Dumbledore's forbidden chamber, Harry shrieked and jumped back and collided with Professor Snape, sending the two of them down in a heap. Professor Snape picked himself up and resumed standing in front of the door, his head tracked to look at Harry.
"I am guarding this door at the headmaster's orders," said Professor Snape in his usual sardonic tones. "Be off with you at once, or I shall deduct house points."
This was bone-chillingly creepy, but Harry's attention was occupied by the gigantic, three-headed dog, which had lunged forward, only to be stopped meters from Harry by the chains upon its three collars.
That,
Harry said. "Yes," Professor Quirrell said from a ways behind him. "That is indeed the usual occupant of that chamber, which is off-limits to all students, especially first years."
"That's not safe even by wizard standards."
Within the chamber, the enormous black beast gave a multi-voiced bellow, flecks of white saliva flying from three fanged mouths. Professor Quirrell sighed.
"It is enchanted not to eat students, just to spit them back out through the door. Now, boy, how would you recommend that we deal with this dangerous creature?"
Harry stuttered, trying to think over the continuing roaring of the chamber's guardian.
If it's like the Cerberus from the Muggle legend of Orpheus and Eurydice, then we have to sing it to sleep so we can pass
Avada Kedavra."
The three-headed beast fell over. Harry looked back at Professor Quirrell, who was giving him a look of extreme disappointment, as if to ask whether Harry had attended any of his classes, ever.
"I sort of assumed," Harry said, still trying to catch his breath, "that going through this challenge in any way except the one used by first years might perhaps trigger an alarm."
"That is a lie, boy. You simply did not remember your lessons when you faced the occasion in true life. As for alarms, I have spent months befuddling all the wards and trip signs upon these chambers."
"Then why did you send me in first, exactly?"
Professor Quirrell just smiled. It looked significantly more evil than usual.
"Never mind,"
Harry said, and walked slowly into the chamber, his limbs still shaking. The chamber was all of stone, illuminated by a pale blue light that shone from arched nooks carved into the wall. As if the light of a grey sky were passing through windows, though there were no windows. At the far end of the chamber was a wooden trapdoor upon the floor with a single ring attached. In the middle of the chamber lay a gigantic dead dog with three lifeless heads. Harry turned toward one of the arched nooks and looked inside. There was nothing there but the sourceless blue glow, so he walked over and looked in the next one, also scrutinizing the wall as he passed.
"What," said Professor Quirrell, "are you doing?"
"Searching the room," Harry said. There could be a clue, or an inscription, or a key we'll need later, or something.
Are you serious, or are you deliberately trying to slow us down? Answer in Basildang.
Harry looked back.
Was serious,
hissed Harry.
Would have done same if came by myself.
Professor Quirrell briefly massaged his forehead.
I confess, he said, that your approach would serve you well in, say, exploring the tomb of Amon Set. So I will not quite call you an idiot, but still, the false puzzle, the outer form of the challenge, is a game meant for first years. We simply go down through the trapdoor.
Beneath the trapdoor was a gigantic plant, something like an enormous Dieffenbachia, with wide leaves emerging from the central stem like a spiral staircase, but darker coloured than a normal Dieffenbachia, with tendril-like vines emerging from the central stem and hanging down. The base spread out wide with bigger leaves and tendrils, as though promising to cushion anyone's fall. Beneath was another stone chamber like the first, with the same nooks like false-arched windows, emitting the same grey-blue light.
The obvious thought is to fly down on the broomstick in my pouch, or toss something heavy to see if those tendrils are traps,
Harry said, peering down.
But I'm guessing you'll say that we just walk down the leaves.
They certainly looked like they were meant to be a spiral staircase.
After you, said Professor Quirrell.
Harry carefully put a foot down on a leaf and found that it indeed supported his weight. Then Harry took a last look around the room before departing, to see if there was anything worth noticing. The enormous dead dog called enough attention to itself that it was hard to focus on anything else.
Professor Quirrell,
Harry said, omitting the phrase, your approach to dealing with obstacles has certain drawbacks.
What if somebody looks in the door and sees the Cerberus is dead?
Then they have probably already noticed something wrong with Snape, said Professor Quirrell. But since you insist...
The defense professor walked over to the three-headed corpse and placed his wand against it. He began a Latin-sounding incantation that was accompanied by a sense of rising apprehension, the boy who lived feeling the Dark Lord's power as he always had. The last word spoken was Inferus, and it was accompanied by a final surge of
Stop! Don't!
And the three-headed dog rose to stand, its six eyes dull and blank, turning to watch the door once more. Harry stared at the huge Inferus with a horrible sinking sensation in his stomach, the third worst feeling he'd ever felt in his life. He knew then that he'd seen and sensed this procedure before, only without the spoken Latin. The centaur, who'd confronted him in the Forbidden Forest, was dead. The defense professor had hit it with a real Avada Kedavra, not a fake one. Somewhere, in the back of his mind, Harry had thought that if he could just get Hermione back, then he could return to the code of nobody dying, the ethic of Batman. Most people went through their whole lives without anyone getting killed on whatever adventures they had. And that was not to be. He hadn't even noticed the day he lost his last chance to win. Even if Hermione was resurrected now, Harry wouldn't have come through the whole mess without anyone getting killed. He hadn't even learned the centaur's name. Harry said nothing aloud. The defense professor would either confirm the accusation in Parseltongue or lie in plain speech, and either way, the defense professor would have more reason to suspect Harry's next actions. But Harry knew that, although he didn't know how he would stop Professor Quirrell, although he didn't dare any positive act of betrayal, maybe not even making the decision, until it was the time to win. There would never be an amicable settlement between him and Lord Voldemort, for those two different spirits could not exist in the same world. And it was like that resolution, that knowledge of opposition, invoked a strength from what Harry had thought of as his dark side. Harry had stopped trying to call deliberately on his dark side after the day he'd killed the troll. But his dark side had never been something separate from him. It had been something remembered from Tom Riddle. Harry didn't know how that had happened, but, taking the assumption and running with it, whatever echoes of cognitive skill were in his dark side should be there for him to use. Not as a separate mode, as Harry had conceptualized at first, but just as neural patterns with a strong tendency to chain into one another since they had once formed part of a connected whole. This, unfortunately, did not change that Professor Quirrell had the same skills with far more life experience backing them up, and also had the gun. Harry turned and set foot on the giant plant, and began to walk down the spiral staircase provided by the leaves. It had taken Harry too long this time, but he had recovered himself to some degree, despite the grief still weighing him down like thick water. It wasn't a cold steel rod in his spine, but it was something straight and solid nonetheless. He was going to play this through. See Hermione return to life first, and then, somehow, stop Professor Quirrell. Or stop Professor Quirrell first and then get the stone himself? There had to be something, some possibility, some opportunity that would present itself. Some way to stop Voldemort and return Hermione to life. Harry continued his descent. Behind him, the three-headed dog waited, guarding the gate. Chapter 107. The Truth, Part 4. The spiraling leaves of the gigantic Diefenbachia felt like forest loam beneath Harry's shoes, not as unyielding as concrete, but supporting his weight. Harry kept a wary eye on the tendrils, but they remained passive. When Harry reached the bottom of the leafy spiral staircase, the tendrils suddenly whipped out and grasped Harry's arms and legs. After a brief struggle, Harry allowed himself to go limp.
"Interesting," said Professor Quirrell as he floated down from above, not touching any of the plant's leaves or tendrils. "I notice that you seem to have no trouble losing to a plant."
Harry looked more closely at the defense professor, seeing him now without the lens of panic. Professor Quirrell was upright and moving, flying without apparent difficulty. The sense of doom about him was strong. But his eyes were still sunken in the skull, his arms thin and wasted. The sickness had not been bluff, and the obvious hypothesis was that the defense professor had recently eaten another unicorn to temporarily regain some strength. And the defense professor was also speaking like the mask of Professor Quirrell, not like Lord Voldemort, which might not be a bad thing from Harry's perspective. Harry didn't know why, unless it was that the defense professor still needed him for something, but it certainly seemed to be in Harry's own interests to play along.
"You specifically let me walk into this trap, Professor,"
Harry answered, just the way he would have spoken to Professor Quirrell.
"Roles, masks, remind him of how it was between us. On my own, I'd have used my broomstick. Perhaps. How would an ordinary Fastier solve this challenge? If they had their wand, that is."
The plant was now reaching tendrils out toward Professor Quirrell, but Professor Quirrell was hovering just out of their reach. Harry had now remembered Professor Sprout talking about a devil's snare plant, which the herbology textbook had said liked cool, dark places, like caves, though how that could be true of a leafy plant was anyone's guess.
"At a guess, I'd say this is a devil's snare plant, and it might retreat from light or heat. So, maybe a first year could use Lumos? Today, I'd use Inflammare, but I didn't learn that spell until May."
A twirl of the defense professor's wand and a pattern of sprays of liquid shot out from it, striking the plant near the bases of its tendrils, hitting with a quiet splat, and then a quiet hissing. All the tendrils touching Harry frantically shot back and began to beat at the growing wounds appearing on the plant's skin, as if trying to remove the pain stimulus. Something about the plant gave the impression that it was screaming soundlessly. Professor Quirrell finished drifting downward.
"Now it is afraid of light, heat, acid, and me."
Harry stepped off the final leaves onto the floor, after a careful glance at his robes, and then the floor, to make sure that none of the acid had splashed anywhere. Harry had begun to suspect that Professor Quirrell was trying to make some sort of point, but Harry did not know what that point might be.
"I thought we were on a mission, Professor. I can't stop you, but is it smart to spend this much time on messing with me?"
"Oh, we have time," said Professor Quirrell, sounding amused. "There would be a great uproar if we were discovered here, guarded by an Inferius. You did not act like you had heard of such an uproar at your Quidditch match before you arrived in this time and spoke to Snape as you did."
A slight chill came over Harry as he comprehended this. Anything he did to beat Professor Quirrell would have to not disrupt the school, or at least the Quidditch game, because it hadn't disrupted the Quidditch game. Even if enough forces could be called in to subdue Lord Voldemort, it might not be easy to do it without Professor McGonagall or Professor Flitwick, or anyone else at the Quidditch game, noticing. Fighting a smart enemy was hard. And even so, it seemed to Harry that if he stood in Professor Quirrell's shoes, he would not be having leisurely conversations and playing mind games. Professor Quirrell was gaining something by taking his time here. But what? Was there some other process that had to run to completion?
"By the by, have you betrayed me yet?" said Professor Quirrell.
"Have not betrayed you yet," Harry hissed.
The defense professor gestured pointedly with the gun he was now holding in his left hand, and Harry walked ahead to the great wooden door at the end of the room and opened it. The next chamber was smaller in diameter, with a high ceiling. The light shining out of the arched alcoves was white instead of blue. Around them whizzed hundreds of winged keys, beating frantically through the air. After watching for a few seconds, it became clear that only a single key was the golden colour of a snitch, though it was moving slower than a snitch in a real Quidditch game. On the other end of the room was a door containing a large, prominent keyhole. Against the left wall leaned a broomstick, the school's workhorse Cleansweep 7. "Professor," Harry said, staring up at the clouds and flocks of whizzing keys. "You said you would answer my questions. What exactly is all this about? If you think you've secured a door so that it won't open without a key, you keep the key in a safe place and only give a copy to authorized entrants. You don't give the key wings and then leave a broomstick propped against the wall. So what the heck are we doing in here, and what's going on? It's an obvious guess that the magic mirror is the only real factor guarding the stone. But why the rest of this? And why encourage first years to come here?"
"I am truly not sure," said the defense professor. He had entered the room and taken up station well to Harry's right, maintaining the distance between them. "But I shall answer, as I said I would. Dumbledore's way is to do a dozen things which seem mad, and then only eight of them, or perhaps nine, conceal an inner meaning. My guess is that Dumbledore intends to make it seem like I am invited to send a student as my proxy, precisely so that Lord Voldemort, as Dumbledore conceives of him, is less tempted to think himself clever by doing so. Imagine Dumbledore first considering the issue of how to ward the stone. Imagine Dumbledore considering whether to set true dangers to guard the mirror. Imagine him imagining some young student blundering through those dangers at my behest. I think that is what Dumbledore is trying to avoid, by making it seem as though that strategy is invited, and so not cunning. Unless, of course, I have misunderstood what Dumbledore thinks Lord Voldemort will think."
Professor Quirrell grinned, and it looked just as natural on him as any grin he'd shown Harry before.
"Plotting does not come naturally to Dumbledore, but he tries because he must. To that task, Dumbledore brings intelligence, dedication, the ability to learn from his mistakes, and an utter lack of native talent. He is marvelously hard to predict for that reason alone."
Harry turned away, looking at the door on the opposite side of the room.
"It wasn't a game to him, Professor. My guess is that the intended solution for first years is to ignore the broomstick and use Wingardium Leviosa to grab the key, since this isn't a Quidditch game and there are no rules forbidding that. So, what absurdly overpowered spell are you going to unleash on this one, then?"
There was a brief silence, but for the whizzing of keys. Harry took several steps away from Professor Quirrell.
"I probably shouldn't have said that, should I?"
"Oh, no," Professor Quirrell said. I think that it is a quite reasonable thing to say to the most powerful dark wizard in the world when he is standing not a dozen paces from you."
Professor Quirrell put his wand back into the sleeve of his other hand, the hand that sometimes held the gun. Then the defense professor reached into his mouth and took out what appeared to be a tooth. He tossed the false tooth high in the air, and when it came down, it had transformed into a wand that sparked a strange sense of recognition in Harry's mind, as though some part of him recognized that wand as being part of him.
13.5 inches. You, with a core of phoenix feather.
Harry had memorized the information when the wandmaker, Ollie-something, had given it, because it had seemed like it might be plot-relevant. The event, and the thinking that had underlain it, both felt a lifetime distant. The defense professor raised that wand and traced in the air a flaming rune that was all jagged edges and malevolence. Harry took another instinctive step back. Then Professor Quirrell spoke.
"Azrath! Azrath! Azrath!"
The flaming rune began pouring out fire that was twisted, as though the jagged edges of the rune had become the nature of the fire itself. The fire was blazing crimson, shaded further red than blood, glowing as searingly intense as an arc welder. That brilliance in that shade seemed wrong in its own right, like nothing shaded so far red should give off that much light, and the searing crimson was shot through with veins of black that seemed to suck the light from the fire. Within the blackened fire, outlined in the interplay of crimson and darkness, animal shapes twisted wildly from one predator to another, cobra to hyena to scorpion.
"Azrath! Azrath! Azrath!"
When Professor Quirrell had repeated the word 6 times, as much black crimson fire had poured out as the volume of a small bush. The cursed fire slowed in its changes as Professor Quirrell locked eyes upon it, taking on a single form, the form of a blackened, blood-burning phoenix. And something told Harry with a terrible certainty that if that black-burning phoenix met Forks, the true phoenix would die and never be reborn. Professor Quirrell made a single gesture with his wand, and the blackened fire went soaring across the room. It met the door at its keyhole, and with a single sweep of crimson burning wings, most of the door and part of the archway was consumed. Then the tainted crimson blaze swept on. Harry had only a glance through the hole to see huge statues just beginning to raise swords and clubs when the blackened fire came among them and they cracked and burned. When it ended, the blackened fire phoenix swept back in through the hole and hovered above Professor Quirrell's left shoulder, the sun-intense crimson claws staying an inch from his robes.
"Go on ahead," said Professor Quirrell. "It's safe now."
Harry walked forward, needing to invoke his dark side's cognitive patterns in order to maintain calm enough to do it. Harry stepped over the glowing edges of the remaining part of the door and gazed at a chessboard of ruined, huge chess pieces. The alternating tiles of black and white marble on the floor started 5 meters after the ruined doorway and extended from wall to wall, but stopped 5 meters short of the next door on the opposite side of the room. The ceiling was significantly higher than any of the statues should have been able to reach.
I would guess, Harry said, and his dark side's cognitive patterns kept his voice calm, that the intended solution is to fly over the statues using the broomstick from the previous room, since it wasn't actually needed to get the key.
From behind, Professor Quirrell laughed, and it was Lord Voldemort's laugh.
Proceed, said a voice grown colder and higher. Go to the next room. I wish to see what you will make of what is there.
Arranged by Dumbledore for first years, Harry reminded himself. It will be safe.
And he walked across the ruined chessboard, laid his hand upon that door's handle, and pushed it inward. Half a second later, Harry slammed the door and leapt back. It took Harry several seconds to master his breathing and master himself. From behind the door came continued loud bellows and great slams, as of a rock club pounding the floor.
I suppose, Harry said in a voice grown cold as well, that since Dumbledore would hardly put a real mountain troll in there, the next challenge is an illusion of my worst memories, like a Dementor with the memory projected into the outside world. Very amusing, Professor.
Professor Quirrell advanced himself toward the door, and Harry stepped well aside. Besides the sense of doom that was now strong about the Professor, Harry's dark side, or just plain instinct, was advising him not to get anywhere near that black-crimson fire hovering above Professor Quirrell's shoulder. Professor Quirrell swung open the door and looked in. Professor Quirrell said.
Just the troll, as you say. Ah, well, I had hoped to learn something about you more interesting than that. What lies within is a corker haggis, also known as the common boggart.
A boggart? What does that... No, I suppose I know what it does.
A boggart, Professor Quirrell said, and now his voice was again that of a Hogwarts professor lecturing. Gravitates to dark enclosures that are rarely opened, such as a neglected cupboard in the attic. It seeks to be left alone, and it will manifest in whatever form it thinks will scare you away.
Scare me away? Harry said. I killed the troll.
You leapt backward out of the room without thinking. A boggart seeks out the instinctive flinch, not the reasoned threat. Else it would have selected something more believable. In any case, the standard countercharm for a boggart is, of course, fiendfire.
Professor Quirrell gestured, and the blackened fire leapt off his shoulder and poured through the doorway. From within the room, there was a single squeak, and then nothing. They advanced into the boggart's former room, Professor Quirrell going first this time. With the seeming mountain troll gone, the room was just another huge chamber lit by sconces of cold blue light. Professor Quirrell's gaze seemed distant, thoughtful. He crossed the room without waiting for Harry and swung open the door on the opposite wall of his own accord. Harry followed after, and not closely. The next chamber contained a cauldron, a rack of bottled ingredients, chopping boards, stirring sticks, and the other apparatus of potions. The light coming from the arched alcoves was white instead of blue, presumably because colour vision was important to potions brewing. Professor Quirrell was already standing next to the brewing apparatus, scrutinizing a long parchment he had picked up. The door to the next chamber was guarded by a curtain of purple fire that would have looked a lot more threatening if it hadn't seemed pale and weak by comparison to the blackened flame hovering over Professor Quirrell's shoulder. Harry's suspension of disbelief had already checked out on vacation at this point, so he didn't say anything about how real-world security systems had the goal of distinguishing authorized from unauthorized personnel, which meant issuing challenges that behaved differently around people who were or weren't supposed to be there. For example, a good security challenge would be testing whether the entrant knew a lock combination that only authorized people had been told. And a bad security challenge would be testing whether the entrant could brew a potion according to written instructions that had been helpfully included. Professor Quirrell tossed the parchment toward Harry, and it fluttered to the ground between them.
"What do you make of this?" said Professor Quirrell, who then stepped back so that Harry could come forward and pick up the parchment.
No, Harry said after skimming the parchment. Testing whether the entrant can solve a ridiculously straightforward logic puzzle about the order of the ingredients is still not a challenge that behaves differently for authorized and unauthorized personnel. It doesn't matter if you use a more interesting logic puzzle about three idols or a line of people wearing coloured hats. You're still completely missing the point.
Look at the other side, said Professor Quirrell.
Harry turned over the 2-foot parchment. On the other side, written in tiny letters, was the longest list of brewing instructions Harry had ever seen.
What on earth?
A potion of effulgence to quench the purple fire, Professor Quirrell said. It is made by adding the same ingredients over and over again in slightly different ways. Imagine some eager young group of first years passing all the other chambers, thinking they are just about to reach the magic mirror, and then encountering this task. This room is the handiwork of the potions master indeed.
Harry glanced pointedly at the black fire shape on Professor Quirrell's shoulder.
Fire can't beat fire.
It can, said Professor Quirrell. I'm not sure it should. Suppose this room is trapped.
Harry did not want to be stuck brewing this potion for laughs, or for whatever other reason Professor Quirrell was taking them through these chambers so slowly. The potion's recipe had 35 separate occasions for adding bellflowers, 14 times to add a lock of bright hair.
Maybe the potion gives off a lethal gas that's fatal to adult wizards but not children, or any of 100 other deadly tricks, if we're suddenly being serious. Are we being serious?
This room is the handiwork of Severus Snape, Professor Quirrell said, once more looking thoughtful. Snape is not a bystander in this game. Not quite. He lacks Dumbledore's intelligence, but possesses the killing intent that Dumbledore never had.
Well, whatever's going on here, it doesn't actually keep out children, Harry observed. Lots of first years made it through, and if you can somehow keep out everyone, except children, then that, from Dumbledore's perspective, forces Lord Voldemort to possess a child to enter. I don't see the point, given their goals.
Indeed, Professor Quirrell said, rubbing the bridge of his nose. But see, boy, This room lacks the triggers and trip signs that are upon the others. There are no subtle wards to be defeated. It is as if I am invited to bypass the potion and simply enter. But Snape knows that Lord Voldemort will perceive this. If, in fact, there was a trap laid for anyone who did not brew the potion, then it would be wiser to lay wards and give no sign that this room was different from the others.
Harry listened, frowning in concentration.
So, the only point of leaving off the detection webs is to make you not bulldoze this room.
I expect Snape expects me to deduce that as well, the defense professor said. And past that point, I cannot predict at what level he thinks I will play. I am patient, and I have given myself plenty of time for this endeavor. But Snape does not know me. He only knows Lord Voldemort. He has sometimes seen Lord Voldemort shriek in frustration and act on impulses that appear counterproductive. Consider this matter from Snape's perspective. It is the Potion Master of Hogwarts telling Lord Voldemort to be patient and follow instructions if he wants to enter, as though Lord Voldemort were a mere schoolboy. I would find it easy to comply, smiling the while, and take my vengeance later. But Snape does not know that Lord Voldemort finds it easy to think this way.
Professor Quirrell looked at Harry.
Boy, you saw me floating in the air by the devil's snare, did you not?
Harry nodded. Then he noticed his confusion.
My charms textbook says that it's impossible for wizards to levitate themselves.
Yes, said Professor Quirrell. That is what it says in your charms textbook. No wizard may levitate themselves or any object supporting their own weight. It is like trying to lift yourself up by your own bootstraps. Yet Lord Voldemort alone can fly. How? Answer as quickly as you can.
If the question was answerable by a first-year student, you had someone else cast broomstick enhancements on your underwear, then you obliviated them.
Not quite, said Professor Quirrell. The broomstick enchantments require a long, narrow shape, which must be solid. Cloth will not do.
Harry's eyebrows furrowed.
How long does the shape have to be? Can you attach some sort of broomstick rods to a fabric harness and fly using those?
Indeed. At first I strapped enchanted rods to my arms and legs, but that was only to teach myself a new mode of flight.
Professor Quirrell drew back the sleeves of his robes, revealing the bare arm.
As you can see, I have nothing up my sleeve right now.
Harry absorbed this further constraint.
You had someone cast broomstick enchantments on your bones?
Professor Quirrell sighed.
And that was one of Voldemort's most feared feats, or so I am told. After all these years, and some amount of reluctant legitimacy, I still do not truly comprehend what is wrong with ordinary people. But you are not one of them. It is time for you to begin contributing to this expedition. You have known Severus Snape more recently than I. Tell me your own analysis of this room."
Harry hesitated, trying to look thoughtful.
"I will mention," said Professor Quirrell, as the blackened fire phoenix on his shoulder seemed to extend its head and glare at Harry, "that if you knowingly allow me to fail, I will call it betrayal. I remind you that the stone is key to Miss Granger's resurrection, and that I hold hostage the lives of hundreds of students."
"I remember," Harry said, and on the heels of this, Harry's wonderful inventive brain came up with a thought. Harry wasn't sure if he should say it. The silence stretched.
"Have you thought of anything yet?" said Professor Quirrell. "Answer in Basletongue."
No, this was not going to be easy. Not against a smart opponent who could force you to tell the literal truth at any time.
"Severus, at least the modern-day Severus, respects your intelligence a great deal,"
Harry said instead.
I think, he might expect Voldemort to believe that Severus wouldn't believe that Voldemort could pass his test of patience, but Severus would expect Voldemort to pass it."
Professor Quirrell nodded.
"That is a plausible theory. Do you believe it yourself? Answer in Basletongue."
"Yes,"
Harry hissed. It might not be safe to withhold information, not even thoughts and ideas.
Therefore, the point of this room is to delay Lord Voldemort for an hour. And if I wanted to kill you, believing what Dumbledore believes, the obvious thing to try would be a Dementor's kiss. I mean, they think you're a disembodied soul. Are you, by the way?"
Professor Quirrell was still.
"Dumbledore would not think of that method," the defense professor said after a time. "But Severus might."
Professor Quirrell began to tap a finger against his cheek, his gaze distant.
"You have power over Dementors, boy. Can you tell me if there are any nearby?"
Harry closed his eyes. If there were voids in the world, he could not feel them.
"None that I can sense."
"Answer in Basletongue."
"Do not sense life eaters."
"But you were being honest with me when you suggested the possibility. You intended no clever trickery."
"Was honest, no trick."
"Perhaps there is some means by which Dementors might be concealed, being told to leap out and eat a possessing soul if they see one."
Professor Quirrell was still tapping his cheek.
"It is not impossible that I would qualify. Or it can be told to eat anyone who passes through this room too quickly. Or anyone who is not a child. Bearing in mind that I hold Hermione and hundreds of other students hostage over you, would you use your power over Dementors to defend me if a Dementor unmasked itself? Answer in Basletongue."
"Don't know,"
Harry hissed.
"Life-eaters cannot destroy me, I think,"
hissed Professor Quirrell.
"And I will simply abandon this body if they approach too close. Shall return swiftly this time, and then there will be no stopping me. Will torture your parents for years to punish you for balking me. Hundreds of hostage students die, including those you call friends. Now, I ask again, will you use power over Life Eaters to protect me if Life Eaters come?
Yes,
Harry whispered. The sadness and horror that Harry had pushed down flared up again, and his dark side had no stored patterns for handling the emotions.
Why, Professor Quirrell? Why are you like this?
Professor Quirrell smiled.
That reminds me. Have you betrayed me yet?
Have not betrayed you yet.
Professor Quirrell went over to the potions equipment and began chopping a root, one-handed, the knife moving almost invisibly fast and with no apparent effort. The fiendfire phoenix drifted over to the opposite corner of the room and waited there.
All matters considered, in their uncertainty, it seems wiser to expend the time to pass this room as a first year would,
said the defense professor.
We may as well talk while we are waiting. You had questions, boy. I said that I would answer them. So ask.
Chapter 108. The Truth, Part 5. Answers and Riddles. The defense professor had set up a cauldron, floating it into place with a wave of his wand, another wave starting a fire beneath it. A brief circling of the defense professor's finger had set in motion a long-handled spoon, and it had continued stirring the cauldron without being held. Now, the defense professor was measuring out a heap of flowers from a large jar, what Harry supposed to be bellflowers. The indigo petals seemed luminous in the white light of the walls, and curved inward in a way that gave the impression of a desire for privacy. The first of these flowers had been added to the potion at once, but then the cauldron had just gone on stirring itself for a while. The defense professor had assumed a position from which he could see Harry just by turning his head slightly, and Harry knew that he was within the defense professor's peripheral vision. In the corner, a fiend fire phoenix waited, some of the nearby stone beginning to gloss over as it melted to greater smoothness. The burning wings shed crimson light that gave everything in the room a tint of blood and reflected in scarlet sparks from the glassware.
"Time is wasting," said Professor Quirrell. "Ask your questions, if you have them."
"Why, Professor Quirrell, why must you be this way? Why make yourself the monster? Why, Lord Voldemort? I know you might not want the same things I do, but I can't imagine what you want that makes this the best way to get it."
That was what Harry's brain wanted to know. What Harry needed to know was some way out of what was going to happen next. But the defense professor had said that he wouldn't talk about his future plans. It was strange enough that the defense professor was willing to talk about anything. That had to contradict one of his rules.
"I'm thinking," Harry said aloud.
Professor Quirrell smiled slightly. He was using the pestle to grind the potion's first magical ingredient, a glowing red hexagon.
"I quite understand," said the defense professor. "But do not think overlong, child."
"Goals. Prevent Lord Voldemort from harming people. Find a way to kill or neutralize him. But first, get the stone and resurrect Hermione. Convince Professor Quirrell to stop this."
Harry swallowed, pushing down the emotion, trying not to let the water reach his eyes. tears probably wouldn't make a good impression on Lord Voldemort. Professor Quirrell was already frowning, though from the direction of his gaze he was examining a leaf coloured in vivid shades of white, green, and purple. There wasn't any obvious way to reach any of the goals, not yet. All Harry could do was ask the questions that seemed most likely to provide useful information, even if Harry didn't yet have a plan.
"So, we just ask about whatever seems most interesting?"
said Harry's Ravenclaw side.
"I'm up for that."
"Shut up!"
Harry told the voice, and then, on further reflection, decided that he was no longer pretending it was there. Four topics came to Harry's mind as being priorities from the standpoint of curiosity about important things. Four questions, then. Four major subjects to try to fit in while this potion was still being brewed. Four questions.
"I ask my first question," Harry said. "What really happened on the night of October 31st, 1981? Why was that night different from all other nights? I would like the entire story, please."
The question of how and why Lord Voldemort had survived his apparent death seemed likely to matter for future planning.
"I expected you would ask that," Professor Quirrell said, dropping a bellflower and a white glittering stone into the potion. "To begin, everything I told you about the Horcrux spell is true, as you should realize, since I spoke in Parseltongue."
Harry nodded.
"Within seconds after you learned the details of the spell, you perceived the central flaw, and began pondering how the spell might be improved. Do you think the young Tom Riddle was any different?"
Harry shook his head.
"Well,